minister is also is in a meeting now. He's going to have a brief include media briefing, but he's going to join us later. I hope by the time we finish he will be here, but I think he will be here. DJ, I don't want to waste any time. You'll just take us through who are the, with the exception of Mr. Bono, who has already told us that, who are the other people that may be, who are accompanying you, and who is then going to make the presentation. And then I will, yeah, I'll hand over to you. Thank you very much. You are still muted.
Okay. Good morning, Chairperson. And the honorable members and my colleagues. We have Mr. Virgil Stephen, who is the DDG Labour Market Policy and Industrial Relations, and Mr. Kim Ngosin Kalipi, who also comes from Mr. Stephen's branch. We have Mr. Sam Morotoba, who's from the Public Employment Services branch. We have the PLO department, Mr. Tando Ababa. We have Zandi Silemwele from the DM's office. We have Pindi Webo from the DM's office, Matabelo Mataboche from the DG's office, and Garabo Makhane from the DM's office, Weli Ledwego from the DG's office. And those are the officials that are here, Jefferson. And Mr. Sinfield will kickstart the presentation on the collective bargaining. He'll kickstart the collective bargaining presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Very much, Chair. Is somebody called? Hello.
Oh, okay. Yes, he's from the CCMA, Chairperson.
Oh.
He's from the office of the director of the CCMA.
Okay. No, thank you very much. Over to you, Mr. Sifrit, whoever is.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, DG. Good morning, honorable members. We will, as was the process yesterday, round robin presentation, and I'm going to ask Mr. Kalipi to deal with the major part of the presentation. But, Chair, I'd want to...
Sorry for that. Is it possible for us to see your face?
Oh, okay. It's just in relationship to the connectivity problem that I may encounter, Chair. But if do you see my face?
Yes.
Do you see? Okay. But thank you, Chair. If I may proceed, I want to preface the presentation with two or three points, which I think is critical to our understanding of collective bargaining in the country. One is that the ILO has defined collective bargaining as one of the fundamental rights in its constitution, and it's important that we recognize, as the member state of the ILO, that collective bargaining is a fundamental right, and that the right is enshrined in the constitution of the ILO. Two, it further reaffirmed this collective bargaining in the Declaration on Fundamental Principle and Rights as well in the ILO. So, notwithstanding the fact that it's a constitutional imperative, if you're a member state of the ILO, it's also enshrined, as I've indicated, in the Fundamental Principle and Rights at Work. But thirdly, Chair, there's a Convention 154 that delineates and regulates collective bargaining in the world. So in three instances, there are collective bargaining will in the country. There's a further convention 98 that the ILO has ratified, and the country has ratified in relationship to organize and collective bargaining in the country. So that's a one point that I want to raise. So it's not a uniquely South African or uniquely African phenomenon of collective bargaining, but it's a worldwide phenomenon that we are dealing with. The second thing that I want to raise, Jay, is that if you read the Labour Relations Act of the country, there are two fundamental principles that we recognise in the Labour Relations Act, and it cuts across, if you will, all of our legislation. One is the issue of voluntarism. So if you would notice, in relationship to the establishment of bargaining councils, establishment of statutory councils, the establishment of bargaining forums, there's no compulsion that you must or should are forced to belong. But the principle of voluntarism is enshrined throughout our legislation. If you look at the Employment Equity Act, the Department of Labor does not set targets as an example for employment equity targets that you will. It is a principle that is enshrined in the context of voluntarism that you have. But there's a second very important principle that the LRA also deals with. It's the notion of majoritarianism. That is important that if we want to mature collective bargaining, if we want to have labor peace, majoritarianism as a principle underpins that reality that we have. So the two principles that are really there is important. Bargaining happens on various levels, and this again is enshrined on our different pieces of legislation. I'll return to the Employment Equity Act as an example. That as you set these targets for in the workplace, you can't set these targets as an employer alone, but you have to negotiate, you have to deal with, you have to bargain with your employers in the workplace to deal with your standard that you need to set in relationship to Employment Equity. In terms of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, Chair, bargaining becomes an important issue in relationship to your conditions of employment, even at an individual level that you talk of. This discussion, however, deals with collective bargaining, and I think it's important that we understand the hierarchy of bargaining within the country in the context of our legislation. So the hierarchy of bargaining happens at different levels, at an individual level, conditions of employment, your agreement, employment agreement that you sign with the employer. Then you go further down the chain in relationship to workplace agreement that you have, and you go to bargaining council agreement and bargaining forum agreement that you have. So there are different areas of bargaining that the legislation sets out for you going forward. And it's important that you understand the principle that bargaining is not an enforced right that you have. It's a right that is enshrined, but nobody is forced to bargain in the context of what we have. Now dealing with the issue of collective bargaining, I'm going to ask Tim McPherson to just run through this process of the presentation that we have. But there are different levels of bargaining, if you will. You will notice that you also talked about sectoral determination that you... Now, at the establishment of the national minimum wage, this sectoral determination did not die away. It did not go to a silent grave that you have, but it's enshrined within the national minimum wage legislation that protects the rights that have been bargained in various ways in those sectoral determinations. We've established, as an example, the privilege of being part of the establishment, as an example, in the private security sector, where I always say that I established, it is not me that has established a provident fund in the bargain in the security industry, but this has led to further discussion to the establishment of a bargaining council within the private security sector. Likewise, in the cleaning sector, etc., we have established these things. So these rights beyond the basic conditions of employment as that we've established in this sectoral determination still exist and it is enshrined within the sectoral determinations as a subset of collective bargaining that we have in the country. So I'm going to ask him if you could just go through the presentation, Chair, if you would allow. And because you may proceed.
Thank you. Over to you, Mr. Mkhali, please. Is he around? I come from the Eastern Cape. Well, he is also coming from the Eastern Cape. Over to you. As well as indicated, Chair and members, the constitution of the country protects the rights of trade unions and to an employer organization to engage collectively. That's the basis. And as Virgil has indicated, we've ratified Convention 98. And the LRA give effect to the Constitution and the Convention itself. That's what it does, by giving the right of collective bargaining and obligation in case by member state in terms of the ILO. It promotes, and then the intention of the LRA and collective bargaining, the idea around collective bargaining is to promote orderly collective bargaining and provide a framework with which employers and trade unions can negotiate, including employers grouping themselves. Collective bargaining determines wages, terms of condition, employment and other matters of mutual interest, and formulate industrial policy as far as that organization is concerned. And collective bargaining agreements that arises out of collective bargaining, the result of collective bargaining are collective bargaining agreements, which means a written document that is concerning the terms and conditions agreed by trade unions and employers. And you cannot have collective bargaining without having a trade union and without having an employer. You can have a trade union, an employer, or a group of trade unions, or a group of employers coming together to collectively bargain. And there are three terrains of collective bargaining in the country. You've got centralized collective bargaining, like in the metal industry, you've got centralized collective bargaining. It's negotiated and it's done by a number of trade unions that are included in that. And you've got also organizations that form forums to negotiate, like the motor industry that deals with Volkswagen and them. They don't have a formal collective bargaining process that is recognized in terms of the LRA, but they've got an informal bargaining forum that they negotiate with. And the difference between the two is that the bargaining forum agreements that comes out of that collective bargaining process are party-party agreements, and the parties are not extended to other parties. All the parties that sign it implements it. The centralized collective bargaining through bargaining council that become different. Argumentation bargaining council can be extended to non-parties. Therefore, you could have NUMSA and the employer organization forming a bargaining council enter into an agreement, and they ask the minister to extend that agreement to all the parties in that sector if they meet the requirement. That's the highest level of collective bargaining at bargaining council level. And in terms of the law gives parties in bargaining council many rights than any other form of collective bargaining. What they do, they can deal with dispute resolution, they can set up policies for the industry, they can they can also, as I've said, apply to the minister to extend collective bargaining, and they must deal with exemptions and all of those issues. Then the next level is company levels, where company maybe like Ford would have negotiations on the company levels with their shop floors. And the same applies here. It's the party-party agreement is not extended to anybody, it covers only that company, and the result of that collective agreement bind them. And then the last level would be plant level bargaining, where a company in one plant, in could be a plant in Port Elizabeth, Volkswagen in Port Elizabeth, it does not affect any other Volkswagen that is outside Port Elizabeth. It's only an agreement and collective bargaining that takes place in that area, and it affects only that plant. And those are the differences, kind of differences that we have in terms of collective bargaining. Now, as we've indicated, the LRA promote collective bargaining through establishment of bargaining council, and that's the system that is used mainly in terms of this. And the system of bargaining council is voluntary. And then there's a big pressure from I know start to and there's a big pressure to make a centralized collective bargaining compulsory. But at the last time, it is voluntary. You can't force people to collectively bargain. And the system then allows the parties, as you said, to form their own structures. And the law, as I've indicated, gives bargaining council power. The bargaining council, as I said, conclude the agreement. They've got the right to enforce those agreements. They've got their own inspectors who are called agents who enforce their own agreements. And they resolve disputes, as I indicated. They establish funds. Bargaining council can establish funds. They can establish funds for medical aid. They can establish funds for provident funds, for pension funds. They can all establish those funds in terms of the law. And as I've indicated, they could ask the minister to extend the collective bargaining to cover even people who are not party to that collective bargaining. This is very controversial. There are people in the country who believe that should not be the case, but the law supports it, and the Constitution supports it so far. The Constitutional Court judgment supports this process. Therefore, in terms of the law, there's nothing wrong with it, but there's been a lot of complaints about people who are outside the bargaining council on the effectiveness on the extension of bargaining council. And if you look on the result of bargaining council agreement over the years, the workers employed under bargaining council and collective bargaining agreements, where the collective bargaining per se, they've got the best conditions of employment in terms of wages. They've got the best highest wages in the country. All workers that fall under companies or sectors where they are collective bargaining. In the country, we've got about 40 registered bargaining councils. And 21 of them are national, they cover the whole country, 14 of them provincial, and 5 is towns, covering towns, like restaurants covering the Pretoria area and Johannesburg area, separate restaurant bargaining council covering those areas. Now, for the past 5 years, the bargaining council has extended more than 100 collective agreements to non-parties. And those agreements affect about 2.2 million workers. And we don't have the stats for a plan bargaining, a collective agreement. We don't have the stats for company national bargaining and forum, because the law does not require them to supply the department with that information. The only information that we have on what is the extent of collective bargaining in the country is with bargaining council. And bargaining council has even gone further during the COVID-19. They've entered into agreements that were extended to safeguard the safety of workers during this period. On all the directives that were issued, they then took those directives and they asked the Minister of Labour to extend them to the whole sector in the clothing bargaining council. That's what they did in the electrical bargaining council, road freight bargaining council, and the textile bargaining council and parties. That's what they did to ensure that workers are protected. And those bargaining councils, as I indicated, are credited by the CCMA to perform dispute resolution. They enforce their own collective bargaining agreement through the CCMA and the Labour Court. Now, I've indicated this, but the major problems, what are the challenges and problems affecting collective bargaining generally? Now, if you look at our legislation, collective bargaining means is on the premises that trade unions must have numbers. They must represent enough workers to be able to collective bargain. When trade unions lose membership, it renders collective bargaining to collective bargaining. Because without numbers, employers are not an issue. Employers implement the agreement, they can negotiate, they've got the power and the strength to negotiate. But trade unions derive their power from numbers. Now, without numbers, then it renders collective bargaining to collective bargaining. Now, what has happened over the years? You've seen many trade unions coming, breaking from other trade unions and restoring. There's a frustration of labor organizations that has led to diverse positions in the bargaining union, making negotiations cumbersome, difficult to reach agreements because there's a competition among parties and serve trade unions, and the trade unions see their strengths in not agreeing to agreements. If one trade union reaches an agreement with the employer in the same company, then the other trade unions will promise all sorts of things to the workers, saying that if we were part of this, we would never agree to this, we would have given you more. And that's a major, major, major problem. And the other issue that dealing with collective bargaining negatively is infiltration by parties that do not have the interest of collective bargaining at heart. There are parties that come into bargaining council specifically to destroy them, not to ensure that the collective bargaining taking place. For example, if you look on the Metal Bargaining Council. Metal Bargaining Council, for the last now 4 years, they don't have a wage agreement. Their wage agreement expired 4 years ago because of the divisions of the parties, especially the employer side of the parties. They are not able to reach an agreement. Therefore, there's not been any wage increases published by the minister because the parties have not requested any, because the parties are not able to reach an agreement. The same applies with Motor Bargaining Council, MIPCO. For the last 3 years, there has been no collective agreement reached in that council. And those are the challenges that are affecting the structure. Some trade unions were found to be involved in corruption in the last 2 years. Example of SIBAO and the issues that have been taking place against some. And those issues divide workers and destroy collective bargaining. And as I've indicated, the membership of trade unions. And now, this might have caused the factors like the 2018 economic crisis, where trade unions are not able to protect their members because of the division. And however, before this crisis, membership of trade unions, as I've indicated, have been dwindling. And we've got lesser workers represented in trade unions these days. You've got two problems. That workers are no more joining trade unions in the numbers that they used to join them. The second problem is that you've got too many trade unions that are representing the same workers. Therefore, even those that are still members of the union are not in one voice in presenting their problems. Therefore, affecting collective bargaining. What have we done as a department to deal with these challenges? To try and assist with Parliament has gone up. We've gone up our way to ensure collective bargaining does not die. We've amended the Labour Relations Act to allow inter parties that are in majority to extend collective bargaining. The previous law, the members will remember that you've got both parties asking the minister to extend the agreement. Because of this problem of representativity, you find a situation where trade unions are not representative, they don't have majority. Employers would employ the majority of workers in the sector. And then we took a policy decision that says you don't have to have both parties. If one party is a majority, that party that is a majority must be able to ask the minister to extend the collective agreement. We've also, with the members' assistance, amended the law to allow the register of labor organization to approach the court to put an organization on administration instead of deregistering them. And then the last issue that we did in collective bargaining is to avoid the collapse of bargaining councils. The law has now also been amended to give the minister the power to extend the period of operation of funding agreements. Because you have a situation where you've got a provident fund and medical aid fund of the council. Now parties are not able to reach an agreement. If those funds collapse, it affects the future of the workers, the safety of the workers. Therefore, we amended the law, as I said, with a sense of members to ensure that either party can ask the minister to at least keep the operation, the agreement as it is, so that there still be contribution on that. Next, please. Now, the next area that I'm going to talk about is the issue around sectoral determination, which are geared to protect vulnerable workers. Now, the Basic Condition of Employment Act requires that, in terms of that, amendment to provide for propagation to ensure that bargaining councils, workers who are not protected by bargaining councils are able to be protected by sectoral determination. And section 51A with BCA and the national minimum wage in terms of how it should be dealt with in terms of these issues. The commission to investigate the conditions in the sector and advise the minister. That's the process in terms of that. Now, the next phase in terms of setting up is the terms of reference that are published by the minister asking for public consultation in this area. And everybody is allowed in setting in sectoral definition to come and have a discussion with the minister on these issues. And after investigation, a report is issued, the commission is consider the following factors in setting a sector determination. Will employers be able to have the ability to carry their business, the operation of small business, condition of employment and wage differential, the likely impact of any proposed conditions on employment? I mean, those are the issues that the report and the commission need to look at in setting up a determination. And currently, we have around about 10 sectoral definitions in the different sector. Contract cleaning. In contract cleaning, you have a situation where in case of any, you've got a bargaining council. In the rest of the country, you've got a sectoral determination. We've got a ministerial determination for learnership. We've got a sectoral determination for domestic workers. And what is important, members, is that although there's a minimum wage, sectoral determination has got other conditions that still apply. For example, if an employer wants to deduct for accommodation for domestic workers, it's regulated by sectoral determination. Wholesale and retail, children, the transformers, taxi, forestry, farm, and hospitality, as I've said, including contract cleaning. And those are the sectoral determination that we have, including the ministerial determination. I'm not going to go through the definitions of them in terms of that. because they are written in the Center of Information themselves. And I think the issue that we need to explain in terms of Center of Information, the most important one, is that the national minimum wage and the BCA presently indicate that wages that are in the Center of Information will be increased as we increase the minimum wage. And the increase of the minimum wage, the 4.5% increase, also rendered the wages of the in the Center of Information to be increased by the same margin. The Center of Information form part of the basic condition of employment, and they are specifically enforced through the BCA. And for 2020, about 166,000 inspections were conducted on Center of Information. And of these 166, about 162,000 were found to be compliant. This is about 97.6%. It means that there's of those that were inspected, it means that there's about 2.4% that were not compliant. I'm sure members were looking at the numbers would want to know, we don't understand what percentage of the universe. I mean, if you look at domestic workers alone, you've got more than 500,000 employers who employ in that space. And as we almost say in these issues every day, is that you are not going to be able to inspect every establishment or every company. I mean, if as I said, domestic workers less than 1,000,000 and companies, you can't even inspect in every house and in every factory. What is important is that if our social partners can work with us and work on where they are not paid the minimum wage or domestic or the Center of Information, they report so that inspectors can be able to target those companies that are not complying. It does not make sense to target companies that are complying and then we say it's 97%. We've got to target those that are not complying and make sure that they comply. And the enforcement of Center of Information is through the BCA, through the CCMA, and the inspectors, and through the Labor Code. Now, the question also that was asked was, are there any new Center of Information that we intended to introduce? At this stage, because the minimum wage covers all of them, and the wages in the Center of Information are increased review as the National Minimum Wage is reviewed, we have not introduced any new Center of Information, nor reviewed the present current Center of Information. But there are a discussion to see whether should we deal with other sectors. I mean, there's a specific sector like the sectors in the taxi industry, the Ubers, who are outside the law presently. Shouldn't we be looking at that? It's not a Center of Information more than it is an arrangement to bring them in the ambit of the law so that they are also part of the legislation. And those are the discussions that are taking place in the department and at NetLab to see how do we protect those vulnerable workers that are, there's no presence, their contract render them to be not employees. Therefore, they do not get the minimum wage, they do not work under the BCA, and their conditions are controlled by the agreement, the private agreement that they have with the other party, and they are regarded as independent contractors by these companies. And there's been moves internationally to deal with these issues, and those are the issues that we're looking at to see how to deal with them without affecting jobs negatively. Thank you, go on. Next slide, Chief. Thank you very much, Chair. I've dealt with the issues. If there are any questions and clarifications, we'll take them. Thank you very much, Mr. Mkali. Thank you very much. Honourable members, any questions?
Ricardo, Chair.
Who else?
Ricardo?
Who else? All right, I will Ricardo and Ricardo.
Thank you, Chair. I'm afraid I can't put my video on, but I hope you can hear me clearly.
I can see you also.
Thank you. Chair, I have a few questions. Firstly, you know, I agree with the presenters that collective bargaining is a thread that runs through the Labour Relations Act, and it does occupy an important place in the Constitution and in subordinate legislation. But my point is that it doesn't work if you don't have parties negotiating and making agreements in good faith, and if they don't respect the integrity of those agreements. Now, we know that the government reneged on the third-year wage agreement of a three-year deal bargained with the public sector trade unions, and many Labour analysts are saying that this is effectively the death of collective bargaining in the public sector, because essentially what happened is that the state benefited from a collective agreement and then proceeded to pick and choose which provisions of that agreement they wish to implement. So the state got all the benefits of a collective agreement, for example, no strikes for a number of years, but none of the key obligations. On the other hand, many public sector employees who weren't party to that agreement, in other words, the agreement was imposed upon them without their consent, they lost the right to strike, but now they've got no remedy when the state chooses not to implement provisions in the agreement. So my question to the department is, what repercussions will this particular case have for the future of collective bargaining in South Africa? It seems to me it could have pretty momentous consequences for the integrity and sanctity of collective bargaining. And then my second question is this. We all know that we've got a massive unemployment crisis in South Africa, with the unemployment rate at over 40% on the expanded definition, including discouraged job seekers. And my question is, to what extent is it possible that collective bargaining may actually contribute to that crisis, in the sense that we know the Labour Relations Act allows trade unions and employer organisations to form these joint bargaining councils, which can then make binding agreements on wages in particular areas in industries. But this is often crippling for small businesses. So there was the recent case of the extension of this collective bargaining agreement in the restaurants sector, also affecting various caterers, that's been extended to non-parties, and it's going to be devastating to many small-scale operators. And one of the consequences is that presumably it's going to be too expensive for a number of small business owners to abide by, and the result will be that they end up making retrenchments. So my second question to the department is, is research being done on the impact of the extension of collective bargaining agreements to non-parties, particularly small businesses, where employment is concerned? Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, honorable members, colleagues. Chair, my first question will be about unions that at some point engage in corrupt activities. Who is responsible to ensure that they are brought to book? Are there members or any other citizen can report them? Or is the bargaining council, because they are able to see those activities, are they able to ensure that those unions are brought to book? And secondly, what is the the best way to address, for example, the situation that we are faced with in South Africa, those of that of the public sector unions and the Minister of Public Service? I hope Mr. Mkhali will understand what I'm talking about. He talked about the sectoral determination. Farm workers are one of the sectors that are mostly affected by this. And most of them, they are illiterate, number one. Number two, they are migrant workers. And if you can see the accommodation that they are made to pay by their employers, is very, very painful. So my question is, can farm workers form part of those protected by the sectoral determination, or what can they be expected to do so that the sectoral determination protects them? Because the minimum wage they don't benefit anything from the minimum wage. It's not all of them, but some. After giving them the minimum wage, the employers will go in their salaries and deduct all sorts of things, and at the end of the day, they will be left with maybe 500 or 600 rand. Those will be my questions, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mkhonto. I don't see any other hands. Mr. Mkhalipi, can you respond?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. Honorable Kato, raised the issue.
Mr. Sifield?
Yeah, Chair, thank you for the question. I think what we need to do, Chair, if you in responding to the question, I'd like to provide, firstly, before we ask Mr. Mkhalipi to address some of these issues, I would need you to address the first issue in relationship to, and I know it's up for delegation, Chair, but I'd like the teacher to address the first question in relationship to, because that's a broader policy approach question in relationship to whether the reneging of the state in relationship to a collective agreement will have an effect on collective bargaining. I think the DG is well placed to answer that, and we can go to the other issues in relationship to sectoral determination. Research that has been done. So with your indulgence, Chief, may I ask the DG to bring the first one, DG?
Delegation.
I'm already preparing a charge sheet, Chairperson, for that.
So. I think that is very light. I'll hand over to you, DG.
Thank you, Chair. Now, I think the question raised by Honorable Kato, and if you listened carefully to the points raised by Mr. Mkhalipi, that the issue of reneging on the collective agreements is not something that is unique in the public service. It is something that that occurs generally in all the sectors, and that too is a threat to collective bargaining. Now, if you come back to the public service, of course, we as people are responsible for regulating the labor market and ensure that there's stability in the labor market, including in the public service. We are concerned that the agreement has not been honored by government, but we also understand that there are valid reasons why government is not honoring the collective bargaining. But if you purely look at it from a collective bargaining point of view and the principles that underpin collective bargaining, we're very, very concerned from the policy point of view, as we would be concerned if this was happening in any other sector. Okay. So I think that would be my response to the question, because for us, collective bargaining is very, very important. It's one of those safeguards that we have in the law to make sure that the state does not necessarily impose conditions in the different sectors. Those sectors, if those sectors were able to sit and working with the unions and employers, sit and decide what are the conditions that they would like to set in their own sectors, of course, using the policy that we have as government as a guideline, because all the agreements are supposed to be in line with the policies that exist. You can't set collective bargaining below what is already prescribed in the legislation. So we're concerned because collapse of bargaining council would put an added pressure and a burden on us as a department, because when those sectors are able to regulate themselves, they free our inspectors to focus in the much more vulnerable areas where there is mostly the workers there are not organized, and we're therefore able to move and move into those sectors and make sure that they are protected by the law. But if there's collapse, that puts an added burden on us, and that's why we're doing our best to make sure that we support, encourage all the parties, including government, and the unions to fit together, find one another, so that they can resolve the impasse. And that has been our advice as a department to both parties, government represented by DPSA in this instance, and the unions that are affected in this situation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, DG. Mr. Mkali, please. I think it was then Mr. Mkali can come in.
Yes, Chair. Sometimes it's difficult to come in when your boss has already spoken. On this issue, just to touch on this issue of the public sector, this is not unique as a dish indicator. We see it's done by trade unions in many industries. The collective agreement has a provision that during the term of this agreement, there will be no industrial action against the conditions that are governed by this agreement. But we've seen industrial action taking place in many industries when there's a collective agreement. That is an undermining of that collective agreement by labor. Now, in the private sector, what happens when an employer cannot afford to pay the wages in the agreement? In the private sector, the employer issues notice of Section 198 that we're going to retrench. That's an option that the employer has. Unfortunately, in the public sector, government took a different approach and said we're not paying this. But
Under normal circumstances, an employer who cannot afford to meet the terms of the agreement, they go out and issue a notice that you're going to retrench. That also affect collective bargaining, because parties have agreed on an agreement, and they agreed on the agreement on the basis of the number of workers that they would have. Now, the company cannot afford. It issued a notice of Section 198. It retrenches half of the workforce, and that affects collective bargaining. There's no doubt that, but I'm confident that in this country, we are governed by the rule of law. Anybody that breaks an agreement, there are legal provisions. Now, we went to, the labor went to the labor court to challenge that. They lost it in the labor court. Now they are going to the constitutional court. Now, if the constitutional court does not support them, unfortunately, there's nothing that we can do about that. If the constitutional court believes that government has done everything by the book, they've done correctly, the agreement that was entered was illegal, I'm sure members would accept that you can't enforce an illegal agreement if that happens. But there's no doubt that it will create a crack on collective bargaining. I thought that I need to put those issues on the table so that we don't see it as only happening when it's done by the employer in the public service. Even workers in the public service do go out on industrial action and undermining collective bargaining. That was done by all parties. It's done by the employers, it's done by employees themselves. And we think that these parties are committed to collective bargaining. And we've seen strike taking place over illegal strike taking place over a long time. But parties come back and build their relationship and build collective bargaining. And we're confident the same will apply in the labor in the public sector. Well, the courts have pronounced on these issues, parties are going to come back and build their relationship and build collective bargaining. I don't think that collective bargaining is going to collapse as a result of that. It's going to be effective, but it's not going to collapse. Now, the second question Honorable Kato was asking is linked to the first question. Now, your first question says, well, in the public sector, the employer should commit and comply with the agreement and with not taking any action. Then in the private sector, your question says, do the collective agreement affect jobs? Are workers being losing their jobs as a result of collective bargaining? Well, we don't have research indicating that. The only research that we have is research that is done on minimum wage. When minimum wage was introduced, we did the research to find out whether minimum wage affected employment negatively. Has there been a reduction in employment as a result of increase in wages in minimum wage? Remember, the increase in collective bargaining and the increase in minimum wage mean the same thing. And the research came out that there's been no negative effect. Obviously, if to collective bargaining or minimum wage, you introduce high wages that the sector cannot afford, there will be job losses. The same applies with minimum wage. Now, we have not done a research that says, has the job losses that have taken place, there's been job losses, have been job losses that have taken place in the metal industry, in the motor industry, are they as a result of collective bargaining? Remember, job losses are as a result of many things. If companies cannot compete, if productivity is low, and all those issues affect the level of job. Now, that research, nobody has done the research, and that will show and say it is the result of collective bargaining. Therefore, we can't say that. And that's why I'm raising the research that we did in minimum wage that showed that, remember, that when we introduced the minimum wage, the cry was that it would cause job losses. It has not. And if we take that research and populate it in collective bargaining, we're hoping that the same result will be reached in that. Therefore, we have not done a research to assess the effect of collective bargaining per se And if you do that research, you might have to do it in specific sectors. You can't do research over the whole of economic or collective bargaining. You could do research in specific sectors, look at the mental states and say, was it as a result of only collective bargaining? What about other issues that affect productivity, that affect the company itself? On the question by Honorable Mkonto, on who's responsible with the corruption of the union, Honorable Mkonto, unions and employer organizations are independent organizations. They are unions, they are, you could call them parties, and the organizations formed by the parties and are controlled by them. Now, if unions operate differently, the first people that are responsible are their members. The members must deal with it. Just like political parties. If political party does not operate in terms of its own processes, the members of the political parties must be able to deal with that. The same apply with the union. Now, if the unions don't apply in terms of their constitution, then the legislature has got the right to intervene. Now, in terms of the law, the register can do two things. Can deregister that union. Deregistration of the union does not solve the problem of the members, because if the union is deregistered, then that union is not going to be able to serve the same members. Or the register can put that union under administration. But the register can't go in and say, I'm going to dismiss the people that have cause corruption. The members themselves must take those decisions. The only tool that the registers have is deregistration and administration. But as I said, that this organization is a club that is controlled by its members. The members of the trade union are the best people placed to make sure that corruption doesn't take place in the organization. But if it does, and that corruption is not in terms of the union's constitution, then the register came. And that is a blunt instrument, because when the register comes in, the register doesn't say, well, members, you have not done anything wrong. This is the person that has done something wrong. The register looks at the organization, not the individual. And the register then will deregister the union or put it on administration. And those are the only processes that you have in our tools to deal with this issue. What's the best way to assist workers in the public sector in their disputes? The best that we can do, we can encourage the public sector union to take this to the courts of this country and let the courts pronounce on them. There's no rule and there's no way that the department can come and judge parties and say to one of the parties, do this or do that. The law does not give us that power. It's only the court that can pronounce on these issues and decide what other parties have done, whether it's wrong or right. On the issue of domestic workers, the sectoral designation, there's already a sectoral designation for social farm workers. There's a sectoral designation there. And that sectoral designation regulates deduction. It says the employer can deduct for accommodation, the employer can deduct for food that they are providing. And the federal designation limits that deduction. It limits it to a third of the employee's wages. You can't deduct more than a third. Therefore, from where we're coming from, farm workers are already protected by the minimum wage and the federal designation for farm workers, which deals with issues of deduction and all other issues in the farm system. The issue could be that many farm workers might not be aware of this. Maybe our advocacy is not to the right standard, so that they can reach all workers, so that they can know that the employer can only deduct a third of your wage for accommodation and for food. But remember, that does not deal with whether the employee has borrowed money, because their workers have borrowed money from the employer and the employer deducts it. But even in that, the BCA says you can't deduct more than a third unless there's an agreement. You can't deduct first without an agreement, and you can't deduct more than a third of the employee's wages. And thank you, I've dealt with all the questions. Thank you, Mr. Mkalipi. Thank you very much. Members, there are there was the response from the department through the DG and Mr. Mkalipi. I don't see any hands, Mr. Tiffer.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to add two areas to the response that was provided. One is in relationship to the question of the Honorable Cardo in relationship crippling to small business. So the Minister has no prerogative when Bounty Council requests an extension. The law is very clear that the Minister must extend within a number of days the collective agreement. But when the Minister extends the collective agreement, one of the areas that was covered in this area is an exemption process for small businesses in a bargaining council. So small business has the ability to request the bargaining council for exemption to the extent that they require such exemption. That's the one a further response that I wanted to address. The second area is in relationship to Honorable Mkonto's question in relationship to farm workers. We should be very clear, Chair, and Mr. Mkalipi spoke about the ability of the employer to deduct and the limitations on the deduction that the employer may raise against the worker salary. A sector of determination cannot set standards of accommodation. That is not what's in the remit of the department. It's not what's in the remit of the sectoral determination. It's not within the remit of labor legislation. But what the sectoral determination can do is to set criteria in the instance of a deduction for accommodation. So if an employer wants to deduct, if a farm owner or a farm employee wants to deduct for accommodation, the accommodation must meet certain criteria. It is those deductions outside of accommodation, for example, buying the farm shop, that the paying for electricity, that impacts on the kind of deduction that the employer may deduct, in addition to the limitation that Mr. Kalipi has said. So the employer must meet certain criteria for accommodation, although it cannot, if they want to deduct, although they can't set a criteria for what accommodation should look like. But at the instance of a deduction, that deduction must meet certain criteria. And I thought those are important distinctions that I wanted to raise in the context of the responses that we provided. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much. I think we, in the last 2 days, we have been exposed to and be empowered to processes that one thought that we should be empowered on, and that, because that is going to give us an ability to conduct our oversight. And I want first to thank members for agreeing to sit over these 2 days, 1.5 days, and under these difficult situations. It also reflects that we are really interested in ensuring that we are then empowered. Because remember that we are not here because we are not public representatives because we know everything. We are to be empowered by the department, but the department also can't then stand and say they know everything better than us in our scope. So they are also empowered by
when then we get our presentation, because we're still going to have our strength plan to see how far are we, what is it that we can do, what is it that we can do. And secondly is that I want to thank the department and its entities and its units for availing themselves and really taking us through. Yes, it is not going to be a once-off process, Honourable Members. I don't think we're in that stage of that thing that it's only these ones of presentations have done the trick. No, I'm of the view that we'll still have to have another workshop maybe in the second quarter, because the president has said that the country must look into what the ease of doing business. I hope we have listened to that and digested that what then does that mean to us as this portfolio, working together with other portfolios. And we will then have to look into the legislation. And I'm happy that these amendments were done in the last term in terms of the Labor Relations Act. But that does not mean, and it can never mean, that we are to undermine the struggles that were waged by our people in ensuring that we do have these laws. We lost some of them, others lost their lives, for us then to be able to be a country that is stable. Because if then labor never the labor force in the country never took up these struggles and waged difficult struggles. Minister, Mr. Mkalipi, Honorable Montrele, and myself, and relatively all other members will understand. Some of us were physically, emotionally involved. And therefore, as we are engaged on this, that's one other thing that we must not lose sight of. Yes, we are to ensure that we improve the high level of unemployment, we improve stability. But we can't, because it means that we then put our country in a very difficult. And therefore, the importance of the Department of Labor or in ensuring that they empower employers and employees with the challenges that are there. We know that domestic workers are in the private world, people who not want to come in the farms, people who not want, but those have got organizations. Farmers have got an organization, have got organizations. Domestic workers have got an organization. It depends on how then do we ensure that they're not being manipulated.
employed. And as much as we do have a problem with that at some stage in how it was, if then foreign workers are vulnerable, exploited, it then means it's foreign workers who are here illegally, and therefore the employer knows that he can go anywhere. This one depends on my message. How then do we? Yes, it's a mammoth task. But how then do we ensure that we empower them? First, them having to register, but expose those workers, those employers who are exploiting and domestic workers and farm workers, exploiting them today. If you listen, if you hear those stories, at times you really wonder that if we say we are a constitutional democracy country, we are a country that is governed by laws, as Mr. Mkhanepi has said, why as people, irrespective. So as we are moving forward, honorable members, that's why I'm raising this thing. Ours is not only to receive APPs, quarterly reports, this, listen to AG. You know, ours is then begin to say how best do we ensure that we work together as the follow committees and encourage departments to work together, not for the benefit of the chair of employment and labor and the minister and the department, not for the benefit of whoever, ourselves, irrespective of our political affiliation, but it's for the benefit of the country, of our people. So, sorry. Having said this, honorable members, I want to thank you very much. We received the presentations. Let's go through them. They're going to empower us. There are amendments that are in front of us. We're still going to be engaged on that. But this process was a process that at least the Office of the Chair wanted us to be more empowered. Because we have got constituency areas where we meet some of these challenges. When you listen to an employee, you get a sense that there is confusion. And these processes are processes that are to always keep our minds sharp, because I can't be dependent on every time that I was exhausted towards up to 1990, up to 2007. Things have evolved. In the next workshop, we'll also invite trade unions. Because, you know, I once said in the Department of Health, when there was an amendment one of the boards in one of their entities, and labor was then taken out, and in asking the department, but why? No, it's because this is a technical board. And then I said, I blew my trumpet. I said, no. When this entity was named ABCD, in it being changed, labor was, one of the stakeholders that was in the forefront was labor. It can't now. We are then told that it's a technical board, and therefore, and it's my worry is that if you are removing labor, I hope you're not removing labor
because you are scared, or you are intolerant. Because if then you add these two, there will never be stability in the Department of Health. But secondly, why do we assume that members of the trade unions and only those that are sweeping the floors? Why do you think that? Because I know for a fact that they are academics, they are intellectuals, they are professionals, they are technicians, that are members of the trade union. So I'm not raising this because at my other life, I was a member of NIHAW. I'm not advocating that it must be NIHAW, but labor must take a decision who represents them in the board, and therefore labor must be part of the stakeholders in the board. And it's our responsibility to ensure that employers, because that's what has happened. That's the difficulty of a constitutional democracy, maybe. People have the constitutional right to be members of the, or not to be members, but what is then our responsibility? Having said that, honorable members, at times, as public representatives, we can't run away from the ideological parts of our work. We can't, because if we forget that, what is important is that how then do we manage, how do we try to balance, and how do we navigate for the interest of South Africa and her people. Thank you very much. I thought we would be done by 1 o'clock, but was short and sweet, but straight to the point. Thank you very much, honorable members. Enjoy your weekend. Prepare for the next week session. I think we are meeting with the SIU, Mr. Sakaza, if I'm